This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Health and Living with me, Ti Xiao Ik. It's Friday afternoon, so it's our Doctor in the House segment with my co-host, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist. George, how are you?
I'm excited because, you know, we have no virtual guests or virtual speakers today, right?
We have a guest actually in the studio
with us. That's right. Physically here. You know, I can see and touch him, right? Okay. No more Zoom.
Our guest has the distinction of being, I think, the first in-person guest with all of you, with you in the studio as well today.
Indeed.
George. We're commemorating World Health Day, which actually was yesterday. Mm-hmm. It's celebrated on the 7th of April every year. So happy World Health Day, I suppose, George. But
indeed,
every day is Health Day for you, isn't it, as a clinician?
Yes. But, you know, of course, it's important to commemorate World Health Day once a year, highlighting different issues. What's the theme of World Health Day in 2022?
Interesting one. Our planet, our health. And it really,
appropriate.
I think it widens that scope so much, doesn't it? We're looking at health beyond just our individual lenses now. We're looking at the impact of Earth. And I think nothing more than the pandemic has really brought that, driven that message home, that we cannot just think about health in our individual silos, communities, or even countries.
Basically, if the planet is in poor health, you cannot be individually, we cannot be in good health.
Yes, and that's what I hope our guest, our guest is a specialist in global health, and I think we're going to find out from him.
Is there
a difference? We're talking about global health and this theme of planetary health, or what, it's become a bit of a buzzword as well. But I'm sure he will shed more light on it. I'm actually interested in looking at this idea of what global health means and these other factors around us, socioeconomic and political factors, environmental factors as well. That
I agree with you. I think for too long we've been looking at health in the kind of micro level. I think it's a good idea to look at it in a different angle, and I'm really hoping today's episode is going to tell us a little bit more about how we look at health globally.
To broaden our lens. And joining us to do that, Dr. David McCoy, research lead at the UNUIIGH. That's actually the United Nations University's United Nations University International Institute for Global Health.
It's a bit of a mouthful.
I'm going to shorten it to UNUIIGH, even though it's a mouthful. But it's the UN think tank on global health, and they're based here in Malaysia. David, thank you so much for joining us today.
It is my pleasure to be here, and I'm really pleased to be your first in-person guest for a long time.
That's right.
Together with George, definitely.
And talking about a very important topic, like today's topic, yeah?
What's your take on the theme for World Health Day?
So the theme about planetary health is absolutely vital and important. I think all of us are aware of the fact that global warming is a real thing, and one of the consequences of that is climate change. But accompanying this heating of the planet has also been other problems associated with pollution, environmental degradation. And this is unfortunately presenting a real crisis to human health, to civilization even. Some people describe global warming as an existential crisis. So it's really important that we discuss this, and it's really important that we see this as a health issue.
And for the UNU, which is looking at global health, is that the same thing as planetary health?
To some extent it is, but global health is quite interesting. The term global health is relatively new. 25 years ago, no one really talked about global health. But now if you go to just about any university in the world, there'll be a global health department. And there are institutes like my one, an International Institute for Global Health. And this notion of global health, which is new, is a response to two things, really. One is, you know, all of the changes that have happened as a result of globalization. The world, as you know, is increasingly integrated. We have an integrated global economy. We have an integrated global financial system. The world is smaller. The world is faster. People talk about the global village. And many of the determinants of health, the factors that influence a person's health, whether they be economic or to do with access to food and nutrition, are now shaped by global forces and global factors.
Mm-hmm.
And so global health is a discipline that looks at how these global factors impact on health.
All right.
The second reason is what we were talking about earlier, this problem of ecological degradation and global warming, and the recognition that everyone's health is connected to the health of the planet. And there are issues that can only be addressed at the global level through multilateral cooperation between countries and by communities all across the world.
Mm-hmm.
So again, this is what global health is partly responding to.
Mm-hmm. David, perhaps I can take a step back and ask you a little bit about your role. Obviously, you know, a lot of us in Klang Valley and in Malaysia are not really aware that United Nations University actually has a chapter or a separate entity in Malaysia. Can you explain a little bit about this organisation and also what sort of role do you play in that organisation?
Sure. So the United Nations University, it's called a university, but it's really a think tank.
Mm-hmm.
A think tank that was set up to inform the United Nations system more generally. It was set up to be an independent entity within the UN system to do research that may be of use for policymakers and for people working within the wider UN system. The headquarters are in Tokyo, and there are 13 separate institutes dealing with different topics or issues. One of them is an institute dealing with global health, and that happens to be based in Kuala Lumpur.
Wow, okay. And then is that strategically placed in Kuala Lumpur because we are the naughty amongst the kind of nations to pollute the countries and all of the world? Or is it just by coincidence that there's a lot of kind of active research that's happening in Malaysia?
Yeah, it's only in Kuala Lumpur for good reasons.
All right, fantastic. I'm glad to hear that. Because otherwise we start getting phone calls from, you know, from the listeners out there kind of like wondering why Malaysia is chosen to be one of the institute to specifically do research for global health.
Well, the reason why is that when the United Nations University went about or decided to set up a new institute for global health, it invited countries to bid to host the institute.
Right.
And Malaysia actually bid to host it.
Okay.
And won the bid.
Right.
And that's partly because Malaysia has actually put down some money as an endowment to help fund and support the establishment of this institute.
Yeah. That clearly reflects that Malaysian government take it very seriously to deal with this this issue.
Absolutely.
Here.
Yeah. And some really exciting research work going on at this think tank as well. But coming back to, if we look at factors, you use the word determinants, that, and these are factors that influence a person's health. And, how has that understanding evolved, David, to this point where we now understand that a person in a kampung in Malaysia, his or her health is not just determined by the circumstances of their birth, perhaps, or access to the district hospital that they have, but it just goes so much wider than that. If you could help draw that picture to make that relevant for us.
Sure. So I think one of the things about global health as a discipline is that it doesn't look at the health of just individuals.
Mm.
It looks at the health of populations. And this is a really important distinction to make, population health versus individual health. Now, individuals all have varying different levels of health, and that's because we are different as individuals. But when we start looking at population health, and we, for example, compare the health of different countries, or the health between men and women, or the health between people who are wealthy and people who are poor, we begin to see these patterns and disparities in health between different population groups. And the reason for these disparities is not because of random factors. It's not because of genetic variation, but it's because of the social, economic, and often political circumstances that those different groups are living under.
Mm-hmm.
And so population health is by definition an approach to health that looks at these systemic factors, social, political, economic, environmental, that impact health at that level of the population.
All right. How does that change the way somebody like George, a physician, dealing with individual patients in his clinic, how would that reframe the way he's helping to manage his patients' health?
Well, as a clinician, you know, you're primarily concerned with the health of the individual. Mm-hmm. You're primarily concerned with that individual's disease or illness. However, I'm sure George is aware that it's not often enough to simply treat that disease. You've also got to think about the living circumstances of that patient.
A holistic manner to treat the
exactly.
person.
Okay. Yeah. You know, their housing, their income level, and so on and so forth. You know, mm-hmm. are they suffering from stress due to conditions at work? Mm-hmm. Do they have enough money to purchase the medicines that they need or to purchase the food that they need for healthy nutrition? So clinicians do look at the individual, and mm-hmm. it's important that we treat individuals. But mm-hmm. the public health profession is there to kind of look at the, you know, the wider context mm-hmm. of individuals and the communities that they come from. Mm-hmm.
David, I mean, I'm sure you're aware that in Malaysia we have this kind of every decade one report card about the state of the nation. For example, the National Health and Morbidity Survey, just before the pandemic was published, and it gave us a list of about 20 entities of, you know, whether we are the fattest nations, we have the most diabetic patients, blood pressure problems, smoking, depression, and all these things. And presumably, this is not really global health that you're alluded to. Is that correct?
Well, to some extent, I mean, when we global health will look at the differences in health between different countries or between different regions. And we do see, you know, significant regional variations mm-hmm. in terms of the health in Southeast Asia compared to the health in sub-Saharan Africa, compared to, for example, the health in Western Europe. Mm-hmm. So there are regional variations. But global health is also interested in looking at how those global factors impact on health disparities within countries. Mm-hmm. So what I was saying to you earlier about globalization, mm-hmm. there are many global factors that will also shape and determine not just the level of health in Malaysia, but also the level of health differences mm-hmm. within Malaysia, because we're subjected to these global forces.
Mm-hmm. What are some of these global forces?
Mm-hmm. Well, some of them relate to the way that the global economic system works. For example, we know that over the last 3 or 4 decades, one of the emerging and now extremely powerful actors that we have operating across the world are big transnational corporations. And they have huge power in determining, for example, what we eat. Mm-hmm. And if you think about the obesity epidemic, mm-hmm. a large amount of that problem that we have mm-hmm. is driven by the supply of junk food mm-hmm. by these very powerful transnational corporations.
So it's not all in people's mind that it's conspiracy that these kind of like things happen. Is that it does happen?
It does happen. And, you know, there's lots of literature and research that's been published to show that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we early on highlighted that these National Health and Morbidity Survey presumably is looking at the physical health. And what you're alluding to, that global health is looking at socioeconomic health and the disparity and equity of that, right? I mean, we do have this report card every decade. Can you highlight a little bit of what sort of like highlights that you have, you know, pointed out or you have research in for Malaysian global health that it's quite important for us to take note?
Well, I mean, there's, you know, Malaysia's general health indicators have improved.
Okay.
And in fact, for many years or many decades even, Malaysia was considered to be a kind of poster child mm-hmm. for good health policy. We managed to reduce infant mortality rates, maternal mortality rates really rapidly after independence in 1957. It's possible to look at those indicators and think that the country has been stagnating over the last few decades. Mm. But, you know, this is not, Malaysia is not alone in seeing some of these stagnating health indicators. But one of the things that we're concerned about with global health is thinking about the future.
Mm.
You know, how, and particularly coming back to this issue of climate change and environmental degradation, there are real concerns that the improvements in health that we've seen right across the world in terms of mortality reduction and life expectancy may begin to reverse and decline.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a result of that fundamental issue of the planet becoming sick. Mm-hmm. And as you were saying earlier, George, a sick planet will mean sick people.
Yeah. All right. Let's go for a quick break and continue this conversation when we come back. The idea of the kinds of health disparities within and across different groups in the population.
And perhaps you'll invite the listeners out there to join the conversation as well.
Absolutely. Do call us at 03-7733-2900 or WhatsApp 018-789-8899 if you have thoughts you'd like to share. We're looking at global health, what that means when we try to break down the idea of your health, our health as a community, our health as a population, as a country. What are the factors that come into play there? And there's a lot more that we want to talk about because David is an advocate for health being a human right as well. So, you know, what does that actually mean? How would that look? Our guest is Dr. David McCoy, research lead at the UNUIIGH, that's the United Nations University International Institute for Global Health. And of course, I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist. So stay tuned, we'll be right back on BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Eek, and my co-host, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist. It's our Doctor in the House segment today, this Friday afternoon. We're commemorating World Health Day, which actually falls on the 7th of April every year. That was yesterday. But our conversation today is with our guest, Dr. David McCoy, research lead at the UNUIIGH. That's the UN's think tank on global health based here in KL. The theme of World Health Day this year is Our Planet, Our Health. And we're taking a slightly different look at it. I think our discussion is in line with the theme because the idea of studying health from this global perspective, addressing health problems from a global perspective, not only looks at healthcare, the elements in the healthcare system that we're familiar with, but other socioeconomic determinants that influence a person's or a population's health, as well as environmental and ecological factors, and how issues like the climate crisis, pollution, deforestation, all these environmental problems that we're grappling with do have an immediate as well as future impact on our health. I want to look at the health disparities that you brought up, David, and really try and understand that a little more. Because we have conversations on this segment. We have been doing that for years, looking at disease management, looking at health policies as well. And we keep coming back to how do we help people manage, prevent certain diseases, manage their conditions? What kind of policies do we need to better safeguard populations and communities and put them in good stead so that they aren't riddled and sickened by these illnesses? So how then could the healthcare sector look at these different determinants, these social factors, economic factors, even political factors, and again, reframe the way we try and improve the health of a population?
So that's a big question.
It is.
I mean, it's worth maybe first saying that just about every disease or every illness has a social gradient.
Mm-hmm.
Nearly all of them.
Agreed.
You know, that generally speaking, people who are wealthier and who have access to a great amount of resources will be healthier than those who don't. So there's a social gradient with just about every disease. There's one or two where the gradient is actually the other way around. You know, this indicates that one way of improving population health, and particularly the health of those who are at the bottom of the social gradient, would be to even out the social gradient, would be to create a more equitable and fairer society. So, you know, if you're a public health practitioner, then that would be one of the obvious things to do, to say, you know, if I want to improve the health of this population, we need to be thinking about the socioeconomic system and how we can ensure that the socioeconomic system is fair and equitable. And that will have an immediate impact on improving population health.
Can I just ask then, you know, in Malaysia, where we have the public healthcare system that provides either free or heavily subsidized healthcare, especially for lower income communities, is that sufficient to address that?
It's a good thing to have a public system that is capable of providing care and services to people who can't afford it themselves, who can't afford to pay for healthcare in the market. Mm. So that's a great thing. But by itself, it's probably insufficient. And we can see that by the fact that there is still, you know, a lot of preventable and avoidable mortality and morbidity mm-hmm. in the population. Mm. So whilst healthcare services and healthcare delivery is important, we do need to be looking more upstream mm-hmm. at the social, economic, environmental conditions that people live in. Mm-hmm. So that's really important. And this thing about disparities, there was a very, very interesting and exciting book that was published about 12 or 14 years ago called The Spirit Level. This is a book published by Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett, which made the argument, and it's entirely based on data and analysis, that countries that are more unequal tend to have worse health than countries that are more equal for their given level of GDP.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, for example, if you think about countries in Western Europe, all of which are upper-income countries, very wealthy, those countries that have a bigger socioeconomic gradient have a worse average level of health at the population level.
Mm-hmm.
That was really interesting because it seems to indicate that the more disparity there is, social disparity there is within a country, that is an independent factor that impacts on the health of everyone in that country.
Mm. So meaning the country's wealth isn't, you know, being harnessed to improve the health of those at the lower level of the gradient.
What it means is that the wealth of a country has an impact on health. Richer countries tend to have better health.
Mm-hmm.
But if a wealthy country is also very unequal, that will then have a negative effect mm-hmm. on the health of that population.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's all good and well that we analyze these things. I want to use in a micro level, let's say, you know, a bus driver mm. who is obviously working 2-3 jobs in order to make ends meet and then has got diabetes. And then he's aware that what you highlighted, that the corporation is kind of like influxing the market with junk food that he's taking because it's cheap. And he's aware that, you know, the crops are all kind of like affected by seasonal changes in global warming. How is it going to be applicable to him in order to change this? Because there's some degree of helplessness when you think about global warming and a big scale and how corporate is changing everything, how political system is distributing resources. A lot of us in the micro levels is just sitting here thinking, it's how can we change anything? Knowing it is just a matter of academic.
I think you're putting your finger on such an important point here, George. It's about, you know, how much power do individuals have?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, obviously individuals do have some power in shaping the way they live, and they have some power in shaping what they eat. But, you know, there are many, many millions of people who are kind of living within a wider system of food production, a wider economic system where their choices and their opportunities are limited and constrained. And this is why governments are so important, mm-hmm. because it's really governments that have the legitimacy and the power to be able to shape the system in which people live and work in.
Right, okay. But a lot of things is beyond the capability of government. Like, so for example, things that you highlighted, that a rich nation obviously will have a rich, healthier nation. However, in the paradox of it, if the gradient of rich and poor divide is very big, then it is reflecting poor on it. But most governments are only trying to keep up in order to get into a next step of the ladder to become a richer nation. And then all these things will just be a byproduct, a secondary byproduct that they can't control anyway, right? In many ways.
To some extent, I mean, governments have a lot of power to be able to shape the systems that people live in. But as we were saying earlier, globalization means that we have a global system that needs to be governed and managed as well.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have a world government. What we do have is a United Nations system
mm-hmm.
where different national governments come together
right.
and cooperate. And that's why the UN is so important. Because
indeed.
In the absence of a world government that can manage the global system, we are really dependent on multilateral cooperation, different countries working together, not just to make the global economic system fairer, but also to address these problems like climate change, which can only be tackled and solved at the global level by countries working together.
And do you think that we've lost sight of the fact that health is so fundamental to every every human being's survival, in the sense that I think have we been looking at health as just as long as I provide or as long as your basic necessities are provided for, that's your health guaranteed. Whereas if we look at health as a human right, that no person should be denied any chance of improvement of health, that we might be going about things very differently.
Yeah, I think we have lost sight of certain things. You know, the World Health Organization Constitution defines health as physical, mental, and social well-being.
Mm-hmm. That social and aspect is
exactly
important.
Social well-being is an important part. And it says that health is not merely the absence of disease and infirmity.
Okay.
So that's a really positive and holistic definition of health. And when you look at the, you know, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the International Covenant on Economic, Cultural and Social Rights, you'll see that embedded within these declarations, these kind of international laws, is a clear commitment to ensuring that everyone has the right to an adequate standard of living and the enjoyment of the highest attainable standard of physical and mental health without discrimination in terms of your race, religion, gender, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, so, this is ideal.
These are absolutely ideals.
Yeah. Right.
But, you know, these are ideals that we should always be aspiring towards.
Okay. Yeah. The utopia. I think we got a caller.
No, yeah, okay, let's go to the caller first. Got some thoughts that we'll follow up with later. Good afternoon, Dr. Hushman. You have a question for us today.
Yes, hi, Dr. Hushman. I was formerly the head of the healthcare working group for ASEAN Business Council. So I want to ask a related question, and thank you for the timely topic. So coming closer to home, looking at ASEAN, 10 countries, now, global health at a more regional level, has the IIGH done any study on the impact of ASEAN health because of the free cross-border movement that affects each other, each of the nation, mm-hmm. movement of diseases, control of diseases, as well as socio-political, economic situation? So global health in an ASEAN sense, has there been any study and what is the general outcome? Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. Dr. Hushman will answer that on air. Thank you.
Thanks. That's a really excellent question. And in fact, increasingly, people who've been working in this field of global health are recognizing the importance of also thinking about regional health.
Mm-hmm.
And although we haven't done any specific studies yet on the ASEAN region specifically, that is something that we hope and intend to do, because it is important to kind of not just look at the global level and then at the level of countries. There are a number of important factors and forces that operate at the regional level that need to be looked at as well. Mm-hmm. And there's a real opportunity, I think, for countries in the ASEAN region to cooperate and collaborate to improve population health right across the region.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for that question. And that's definitely something that we'll be wanting to
look. What's your gut feeling when it comes to this question?
And if we look at other regional blocs, for instance, the EU, I'm just plucking that out of thin air. I know very different circumstances, but, you know, what can we look at from these blocs in terms of how they address regional health issues?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots to be learned about cooperation at the regional level. And sometimes, you know, we were talking about the need for countries to work together and cooperate. And sometimes it can be easier to cooperate at the regional level.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get a lot done through that level of cooperation than if you're trying to cooperate at the global level where you've got, you know, 180 plus countries
mm-hmm.
to have to cooperate with. So,
you become a bigger voice, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's also another really important point, is that the countries of ASEAN, if they speak with one voice, they're able to have much more influence at the global level.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot to be gained and won from regional level cooperation.
All right. We'll go for another break and come back. Still more to discuss on this issue of global health. Human rights, health as a human right, the role of ensuring equity within the populations to improve population health. Our guest today is Dr. David McCoy, research lead from the UNUIIGH, that's the United Nations University's International Institute for Global Health, and my co-host, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist. We are commemorating World Health Day on the show today. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Ik, and my co-host for our Doctor in Health segment, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist. Joining us on the show today, Dr. David McCoy, research lead from the United Nations University's International Institute for Global Health. And we are commemorating World Health Day on the show today with the biggest picture look possible. We're looking at global health.
Planetary health as well.
Yes. We're looking at the impact of the environment on our health. We're looking at the impact of economic systems, financial systems, political factors as well. All of these aren't factors in a void. They do have an impact on issues like access to healthcare, whether you're able to afford, whether you're able to put food on the table, and as a result, then can look at improving your health. That sounds very simplistic, but would that be a way of looking at it?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, there are these very famous graphs that were produced in England, which showed the mortality rate from TB and the mortality rate in children from common infectious diseases from the middle of the 19th century all the way to the middle of the 20th century. And what you can see on this graph is a steady decline in deaths from TB and common infectious diseases amongst children. And you see this decline until, you know, there was about an 80% reduction by about 1950. And what's really interesting is that this 80% decline happened before there were antibiotics and vaccines available to treat TB mm-hmm. and those common infectious diseases. What caused that 80% decline in mortality was improvements in housing, improvements in nutrition, and improvements in working conditions.
Mm-hmm.
So that really kind of demonstrates very powerfully how these wider social and economic, how development, human development can protect you against diseases.
Mm. And something that you do see in a greater amounts across populations, but do you think that then masks the disparities of those who haven't reached that level of development?
It does. And, you know, this is not to say that medical technologies aren't important, and vaccines and antibiotics in particular have been incredibly effective at reducing mortality. But it has also meant that we've been able to keep people alive in conditions of poverty mm-hmm. in a way that we couldn't do before. So to some extent, we are masking the problems that many people have
creating
with their living
problems.
Conditions because we have these powerful medical technologies, vaccines and antibiotics in particular. There is a concern, of course, that we're losing the ability to use antibiotics because of the development of antimicrobial resistance. So technology is very powerful, but it does mask in many instances the kind of wider social conditions in which people live in.
Agreed.
Is this a conversation only for the public health sector to be having? Or, you know, do we look also at what communities can do? Do we look at what individual healthcare workers like George can do?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely not just for public health specialists. This is a whole of society issue. What kind of society do we want? You know, what kind of health do we want? We shouldn't just be looking at mortality rates. We shouldn't just be looking at life expectancy. We should also be looking at the quality of life. And in fact, there's lots of data showing that mental illness is on the rise. People's levels of anxiety and stress is on the rise. So although their physical health may be good, their quality of life in many instances is not so good.
All right. The environment, that's sort of like the elephant in the room that I don't know how to address. And we do know that the climate crisis has effects on our lives and on our ability to survive across generations. But really, how are you bringing these two together, the environment and health?
I think no one can talk about good health without talking about environmental health. No one can talk about human health without talking about planetary health. And in many respects, it is one of the big issues that we have to address as a health community. Just a couple of days ago, WHO released a report showing that 99% of the world's population is breathing polluted air that is above the kind of internationally accepted standards of clean air. So the degree of pollution, the degree of environmental damage that we've caused as a species is really shocking and potentially catastrophic. So WHO and other global health organizations are now paying a lot more attention to what we can do to address climate change. But ultimately, this is really a problem that is rooted in our economic system, our political system, our dependence on fossil fuels. There are solutions, but at the moment we're not actually, the politicians and those in positions of power are not pressing the right buttons and pulling the right levers.
Similarly, you would like to allude to the whole idea of individually, in a micro level, we all have the power to change this for the future. I mean, for example, a lot of us using the bus drivers, example again, that most of us would feel helpless when it comes to changing the political system, economic distributions of resources, and leave alone the planetary condition. So in some examples, can you give us examples of what sort of things we can do in order to change this massive scale of climate change?
Yeah, I mean, I think we can all do a bit better as individuals, but it's really important that we don't place this problem on the shoulders of individuals. This is a systemic and structural problem, and it requires systemic and structural solutions. And really, that's what governments are for. So whilst we can tell individuals that they must pollute less and
recycle,
eat more green and recycle, that is not going to be the solution. We have to address this at a systemic and structural level. And that requires governments and bigger institutions.
Is it too little, too late?
It has certainly been too little, too late for the last 3-4 decades. The question is, will it keep continuing to be too little, too late?
Has the pandemic worsened anything?
I think the pandemic in some ways has been a good thing, and it's kind of opened up the eyes to many people that we do live in this single interconnected world, and we live in a fragile world, and our lives can be turned upside down, you know, almost overnight. We've seen how a virus can travel across the world in a matter of minutes, or perhaps not minutes, but days and weeks. And so to some extent, going through this COVID pandemic has kind of possibly created a sense of global solidarity.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, we've also seen the inequities that exist within the global world, you know,
indeed,
just in terms of COVID vaccine inequities.
Mm-hmm.
So it might be too early to say whether COVID has created some kind of opportunity for everyone to actually recognize mm-hmm. that we live in a single planet and that we need to cooperate to improve everyone's health or not.
Yeah, there were reports that the restriction in movement and cross borders and that sort of things had given Mother Earth an opportunity to breathe, and all the flora, faunas and all kind of regenerated. Is there any evidence of that?
That's what I thought was going to happen. But unfortunately, the data suggests that our emissions of greenhouse gases has continued to rise, despite the fact that COVID did result in a reduction in flying and flights. And, you know, that there was some diminishing activity, economic activity, that was detrimental to the planet. But unfortunately, the data does not seem to show that that was enough to actually reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
Mm.
2 years is a drop in the ocean when you consider how much we, how much the kind of carbon footprint we have.
Yeah.
I just want to read this message from Madiha, who says that the Ministry of Health should find possible solutions for a sustainable healthcare system similar to the Greener NHS initiative in the UK. Are you familiar with this? Any thoughts you'd like to share?
Yeah, I mean, in the UK, the National Health Service has quite a big carbon footprint. The health system itself is an actor within society that produces greenhouse gas emissions.
Mm-hmm.
And so the health system itself can play a role in demonstrating how we can change towards more renewable energy, towards more recycling. If you think about plastic pollution, a huge amount of that is actually produced by the medical industry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the amount of disposable, single-use syringes and so on and so forth. So there has been a big push within healthcare systems across the world to see how we can, you know, provide healthcare in a way that's more sustainable and less polluting.
Mm. I don't know. This conversation is so huge. There's so much to grasp. Right? This is your life's work, David. But you know, if we wanted to sort of just bring it back to something we can grasp, where do you think we should begin? Where do you think the Malaysian government could begin?
Oh, that's such a difficult question.
Starting point.
I often say to my students, like when you're dealing with complex problems, don't look for a simple solution, because mm-hmm. that simple solution will nearly always be inadequate or wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, complex problems do require mm-hmm. us to kind of think about how we address, you know, the complex problem through a set of systemic interventions and solutions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've alluded to the importance of governments acting, and that for me points to the fact that we need to be able to hold governments accountable for their duties and their responsibilities, but also support and enable governments to work effectively. Mm. I've alluded to the fact that we need governments to work across national borders
mm-hmm.
and cooperate at the global level. And again, the public can encourage governments like the Malaysian government to play a leadership role at the global level,
mm-hmm.
lead by example, not just at the global level, but also at the regional level. So, you know, there are many things that we can do, but I think it would be wrong for me to suggest that there is one thing that we can do that will then solve mm-hmm. these problems.
Why should governments care then? Because if our healthcare indicators and the basic things, we look as if we're doing a good job. Mm-hmm. Infant mortality, maternal mortality, all that seems good. So how do we make governments care that there are deeper problems?
Well, I'm hoping that, you know, we see governments as being part of us. You know, ideally, governments represent the public.
Mm-hmm.
And so if the public cares, then governments should care.
Mm-hmm.
But really, governments have a responsibility for looking after the public, looking after the population. I think what governments need to do is to think more long-term than they currently do. Mm-hmm. You know, many governments all across the world are thinking about the next election. They're thinking in short-term electoral cycles, and that's always been a problem right across the world.
Yeah.
The UN system is partly there to remind governments that we need to be thinking long-term. We need to be thinking about the futures of our children mm-hmm. and, you know, subsequent generations. But, you know, ultimately, when we're thinking about structural and systemic change, when we're thinking about having to regulate the way fossil fuel companies, for example, operate, the way transnational food corporations push junk food onto people, causing this obesity, we need regulations to be able to stop that from happening. Mm-hmm. And government, only governments have that legitimacy and that power to institute mm-hmm. regulations mm-hmm. and laws yeah. to protect people.
You pointed out something that if the public cares, then we can change something. And if the government cares, definitely can work together to that ideal. Do you think the public cares at the current state? And then do you think the government cares currently?
I think the public do care. Surely the public cares about the future of their children.
Pointing out the situation of that bus driver again, you know, in order to put make ends meet, put things, you know, food on the table, making sure the least they can do is make make sure that children can have enough food for the next, before the school day, the next day. In a way, all these are kind of ideals that most micro level would think that it is not achievable, not changeable. So how do we make individuals like us care more?
Yeah.
Because a lot of time, you know, Xiao Yik asks you to point it out, to point out a few points to make sure that the government can solve the solutions. You highlighted that this problem is way too big. Simple solutions is simply not there. So in a way, pointing out all these deficiencies and all the shortcomings is just a matter of academic.
Well, I mean, it's not academic because it has real impacts on the lives of people. But I take your point. You know, there are millions, if not billions, of people living on less than $2.50 a day
mm-hmm.
who are just struggling to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And asking them to address these complex problems is you know, it would be pointless and not appropriate. So we do need to be looking to people who've got the resources, the time, the ability to kind of make these systemic and structural changes happen.
Indeed.
But you're right. You know, something like half the world's population is currently living on less than $2.50 a day.
Mm-hmm.
And then another 20 to 25% would be living between $2.50 a day and $10 a day. So this, again, points to one of the problems that we have, which is this huge maldistribution of resources and wealth across the population. Something like 50 individuals own as much wealth as the bottom half of the entire world's population.
Mm-hmm. I think recent figures probably show about 10 individuals own 99% of the world's wealth, probably.
Yeah, I mean, it's a shocking statistic, mm-hmm. You know, this level of inequality.
Mm.
But again, you know, there are solutions to this. There are ways in which we can redistribute wealth through better and more effective tax systems and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
I think if nothing else, today's conversation, it really drives home the point that, you know, we call the show Health and Living. It's not just about health. It's everything that comes in together with life.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't afford to ignore all of those factors. Thank you so much for joining us on the show today, David. We've been putting Dr. David McCoy on the spot, asking him some difficult questions. And he's been explaining to us very capably the importance of looking at health on a global level. Dr. David McCoy, research lead from the United Nations University International Institute for Global Health. And of course, my co-host, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist. This has been Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.